A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi. This is Dawn Sawyer from Dallas, Texas, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Dawn, for your lovely intro to the show. Catherine, how do we know Dawn?
Dawn is the mum of lovely Star, who was supposed to be our French Open mascot, but she sadly passed away earlier on this year. My mum did a portrait of Star, a lovely portrait, and I know she keeps in touch with Dawn and speaks so highly of her and her support for the podcast and everything. So Dawn is a very prominent member of the Tennis Podcast community. So yeah. hello lovely Dawn. And I still think of that lovely picture of Star with the mortarboard on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's still makes me happy, that picture.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks so much for your support, Dawn. Really appreciate it. And to everybody else who's backed us this year in our Kickstarter, which has got us all the way through 137 episodes, I think we're up to, something like that. I think it might even be 140 now. And that's what we've done so far this year. And we are into the eighth and final daily from the ATP finals. And Catherine is sitting in the room that she's going to be vacating in the morning at the O2 Arena inside the bubble. She's going to be let out into the community tomorrow, but not before discussing victory in the 12th and final edition of the ATP finals held in London. We'll get on to a few memories of the place a little bit later, but first of all, we should really talk about the edition that we've just concluded. And Matt Roberts is here. Hello, Matt. You're right.
Very well. Thank you, David.
Good, good. So Matt's been watching. Catherine's been presenting live TV. I've been watching and cooking and just generally plate spinning in my house. And Daniil Medvedev's been fighting his way back yet again from a seemingly, well, certainly a perilous position in a match to win the title. A hell of an achievement, isn't it?
You say perilous position. Medvedev says, I've got you right where I want you.
That's it. That's true. He's a revelation, that guy, isn't he? I mean, I sort of forget how cool he is from that US Open of a couple of years ago. Was it 2 years ago?
Last year, that was David.
this is how everything is. And then we got into the sort of the bit where he went to corporate Medvedev, and I was talking about the metronomic winning of titles, and that's all we would have. And now it feels like he's melding the two perfectly. I've really enjoyed Daniil Medvedev this week.
Yeah. I mean, the match was good and everything, but how soon before we can talk about his celebration or lack thereof?
Let's talk about the match first.
Okay, no.
let's build our way up.
Matt can do that.
So, right. Matt, they came in, these two. What was the head-to-head between these two when they started this match?
I think it was 3-1 to team.
Yeah, and one of those was at the US Open recently, wasn't it? Where I remember in the pre-match press conference or the one after he'd beaten Nadal, Medvedev said, "When I played Team in that US Open match, I played really well." And that's a measure of how well Dominic Thiem was playing and how many the sort of difficulties he can cause. And I remember watching that match, and I remember, I think I might have even picked Medvedev to win, or at least I felt like he had a really good chance because he was playing well and all the reasons. But ahead of this one, he was aware of how destructive Thiem is. And really, is Medvedev a slow burner? Is he a slow starter? Or was that Thiem just coming out of the blocks like at a million miles an hour?
I don't think Medvedev necessarily had a slow start today. I just think he played one terrible game on serve in that first set and lost his serve. I mean, I feel like we just need to sort of take the conversation we had yesterday about Medvedev and insert it into this podcast, because it felt like a copy, basically, of the match he played against Nadal. He was actually probably certainly as good a player in the first set, but one bad game cost him. It was really inexplicable. It was a double fault. It was two forehand errors. It was a smash into the net.
He was 40 love up, wasn't
he? Yeah, it was a really bizarre moment.
If you were trying to tank a game, which of course he wasn't, but that's what it would look like.
Yeah, he suddenly really couldn't find the court.
yeah.
And then he was hanging on a bit in the second set, and Thiem was looking like the better player, I felt. He certainly had a couple of break points, either at 3-all or 4-3, whatever that game was, when Medvedev was serving. And Thiem missed a forehand. He just pushed it long. And that was his chance, because after that, I thought Medvedev began playing way more fluently. And he did exactly what he did against Nadal and started changing the tactics mid-match. He came to the net 20 times in that second set. I mean, I know we've talked about his flexibility and the options at his disposal, but the sort of main way I would describe Medvedev is a baseliner and someone who is going to grind away. He does have the options, but he really used those options in this match. And I just thought it was the second match in a row where he's outthought an opponent, and also the second match in a row where he's physically outlasted an opponent. I thought Nadal looked quite fatigued at the end of that semi-final, and I thought Thiem did, whereas Medvedev just kept going, just kept getting stronger. And it kind of was the quintessential Daniil Medvedev performance, I think.
Mm. So you won the title. Catherine, you can talk about the celebration now.
Well, it was just a shrug, wasn't it? It was the coolest shrug in the history of sport. And he's totally owning it. He's saying, yeah, this is my thing now.
Yeah.
I celebrate with a shrug.
And I loved how he said that last year during the US Open, he thought to himself, great players have a thing. They have something iconic that they do. And he thought, I want a thing. And and he decided that it's going to be to not celebrate.
What a brilliant trademark.
Yeah.
What a great brand to have. I'm the bloke. He actually said in professional football or soccer, if you're in America, you see players sometimes score and not celebrate. Now, personally, I get really furious when that happens for my football team. If somebody scores for my team and doesn't celebrate, it winds me up. They usually do it in pre-season when the matches don't matter, or they do it when they're playing a former club, which I kind of understand, but it started to become, if you do celebrate against a former club, you're a complete so-and-so. But here, where you've got everybody falling to the knees, jumping, punching the air, climbing into the crowd, to have one bloke who's just won the biggest title of his life and is ecstatic, just look like he's just held serve for 2-1 in the first set. Because the other thing he did, not only did he just sort of shrug, he also patted the ball back to the ball kid and just walked off.
It was so baller. It was just great. And to have the self-awareness and humility to just admit it, yeah, I wanted a thing. This is my thing. And to not pretend like, oh, it was just spontaneous, like, you know, oh, am I doing that? I didn't realise. and that his thing is so un-naff. Like, so many things are just naff, you know. I know people like Gareth Bale and his heart and, you know, the Wonder Bra and, you know, each to their own. But a shrug is really wonderfully un-naff.
And he says he has to stop himself from celebrating. You know, he's fighting his natural instincts. But
he wants to do... I remember here last year when, you know, I was still experiencing US Open fever after you guys. It's because of you. I interviewed him before the tournament and I asked him about his little dance, you know, that's now one of the all-time great tennis gifts. And I said, oh, if you win here, will you do the dance? And with a little twinkle in his eye, he said, yeah. And obviously I jinxed him and he didn't win any matches, so the dance was off the menu. Anyway, he's gone from sort of the Medvedev wiggle to
which was a little bit Peter Korda scissor kick back in the late 90s, which is what he used to do. But the problem with and remember when Andrea Petkovic used to have her dance, the Petko dance, and the problem was those are great when they happen the once, but then when they become the trademark and they have to keep rolling them out, sometimes you don't. I can see they don't really want to do them, but this works for every occasion.
Although I do feel slightly sorry for photographers.
Yes, we did get a note from Ella Ling about that.
Did we? Yeah.
Yeah, she said this is a nightmare for me.
Because I wonder whether now with Medvedev matches, they're going to sort of reframe and go for the great loser shots. Because I know they're not going to get anything out of Medvedev.
Although, if you just capture that peak of the shrug, where the lips are at their most downturned and the shoulders are up,
you got to do a good caption with it, I think.
Really?
Yeah, probably.
Well, not if he becomes so
known
present in the public consciousness that people know it. I think at this stage, yeah, I get that it's not great.
The only thing I don't like about him owning it to this degree is I quite liked the idea that the opponents didn't know that that's what he was doing. I loved the thought that a Nadal might be looking across the net and thinking, he's just beaten me and it seems to mean nothing to him.
I still think it will wind them up a bit.
He's that cool. He's that cool that he doesn't even, that it's not a big deal.
But it's not that, is it? Because he's owned it and said, this is my thing. I think it negates that personally. He's not trying to pretend that he doesn't care or that he's too cool to care. He's telling you, I really care, but I want to have a cool thing.
But wouldn't it be cooler if he really didn't care?
No, not caring isn't cool.
All right, okay, that he did care, but they didn't know he cared. That's the thing, isn't
it? I think it's cool to care, and it's fine for people to know you care. This was a public service broadcast from the Tennis Podcast.
He's like a WWE character. I love it.
So this isn't the metronomic winning of titles then, David?
No. This is the Velociraptor coming of age before our eyes, returning to his former glories.
He's just
balanced it, Catherine, to perfection. He's balanced that euphoric moment of going to war with a New York crowd on his own. He's married that with winning and also having a twinkle in his eye that we kind of know about. But, you know, I'm really liking it. And my word, was his tennis good as well today.
I do hope we're still going to get some 2019 US Open antics from him.
Of course we will. Matt, don't forget what he said to the umpire at the US Open recently.
Oh, for sure.
What was that?
Yeah, for sure.
What did he say?
Well, it was against team. Because he had a very small meltdown in that first set against Thiem at the US Open, where he disagreed with a call and he actually crossed the net to go and look at it, which is a big a big no-no. And then he said something like, "My sincere apologies to the US Open."
I killed somebody.
My sincere apologies. It was this sort of incredible sarcasm. But he's shown that he can win even when he's doing, well, okay, maybe not quite win. He didn't win the US Open last year, but he can still have brilliant results while doing all that kind of stuff. But also he can win when he's in just completely in the match zone like he was in this week. He does seem to have both traits, which is perfect, because that makes me think that hopefully we will see more antics from him, because antics are fine, but antics and winning is such a great combination,
especially winning the way he's winning, because his game is really interesting, especially on these faster surfaces like and indoors. The way he just it's almost like he a computer game where you have a secret weapon. And you just decide, when to utilize it, and you flick the switch, and that's what he did. And Thiem did not seem to know that that was coming.
It's almost like a computer game where you don't know the controls when you start, and you have to figure them out as you go. And by the end, you're an absolute pro. It's kind of what he's done in these last two matches, and I think he really kind of rewards you if you watch the whole match.
Yeah, that's very true. He's not a highlight reel player, is he?
Absolutely.
I mean, he does hit some incredible shots, which are great for highlight reels, but the actual enjoyment for Medvedev comes from seeing it through from start to finish, because you see all the options at his disposal and you see him change the way he's playing. And that is so satisfying, I think, for anyone who just enjoys watching tennis being played. There's just so much to kind of learn from him, I think.
I wasn't able to attend the Dominic Thiem press conference because I was recording highlights links at the time. But I think he's confused. I think he might be confused about why he lost that match. Do you think he understands why he lost that match?
Well, I mean, he a little bit like Medvedev talking about their match at the US Open. Thiem said, I only really played one. There's only one point I regret in the whole, pretty much the whole match. He said, "I think he knows what he was up against today."
Well, exactly, but it's far more simple to understand if it's, you know, I should have done this differently. I mean, yeah, I don't think he was at his peak today. Even in that first set that he won, I don't think it was. I don't think it was peak Dominic Thiem by any means at all. But yeah, I wonder if he really. I do wonder if he really understands why he lost. I think he seemed a bit bamboozled in that third set. I don't know. What do you think, Matt?
I definitely think he wasn't at his best today, Thiem. But I think a lot of that is because of what Medvedev was doing to him. Probably
he elongates the matches and he elongates the rallies and just makes you. I think he just tires opponents out a little bit.
But I think maybe Dominic Thiem would think, yeah, but that's what Djokovic does.
Yeah.
And I hit through him. I've got his number. I hang tough. I'm patient. I wait for my moment and then I explode. That's the formula. And if it's good enough against the world number one, why isn't it good enough today?
You said it. You said the way that he's confusing him is tiring making him have to think differently, because suddenly halfway through the match, he's coming to the net 20 times in a set. Mm. I mean, that's just extraordinary.
Mm. And that isn't something that I guess Djokovic does. He does have very Djokovic-like qualities with that solidity from the baseline, but we don't really see Djokovic just suddenly come to the net 20 times in a set. I guess for Thiem, what I would say is that this is one match, and you know, he did beat Medvedev a few weeks ago at the US Open. I think they're going to have an interesting rivalry, and I think you could kind of compare it to Tsitsipas last year. You know, team lost that final to Tsitsipas, but that didn't necessarily mean that Tsitsipas got the better of the rivalry. It meant that they were going to be close in the future, and teams...
And best of five is different,
best
too.
Best of five is different, and teams' trajectory is still so incredibly good and upwards. This is just a minor bump in the road that he'll have to think about when he next plays Medvedev, but I think it would be a stretch to say that he's got a sort of match-up problem with Medvedev just based on this.
By the way, we had a tweet from Stephen Malloy, one of our listeners, who always entertains me with his tweets. And he actually said something here that I found really, it'll stay with me. He wrote, "May I say that Medvedev is the perfect demonstration of why on-court coaching should never be allowed? His massive skill is his ability to problem solve in real time and tactically change up his approach to turn a match. Why should this be negated for cheap TV entertainment?"
It's very compelling, and I'm not disagreeing with it. I would say TV entertainment is not cheap. It pays the bills. I don't mean my bills. I mean it also pays my bills. I mean everyone's bills. It pays for tennis to happen, particularly at the moment. I think just dismissing entertainment value as frivolous isn't really fair. But yeah, I still think there's a compelling point there for sure.
On match point, within seconds of match point having been secured and within seconds of having enjoyed the Daniil Medvedev celebration, I got a text from my mother.
Are we going to talk about that again, the Daniil Medvedev celebration? No,
we're okay. We probably
thought that's where we were going. Yeah, it was great.
Well, I had a text from my mother which said, "Congratulations, you finally got a prediction right."
Oh my God, you're being trolled by your mum.
"Really enjoyed the match," she said. That was it. That was the tweet.
Tweet?
The tweet?
On Twitter?
No, sorry, not the tweet. I mean, it reads like a tweet. Maybe she has got a Twitter account. Maybe she's under some like weird name that I don't know about. Maybe not.
I mean, that would be quite something.
So anyway, he's the champion. Very well done to Daniil Medvedev. And he was also quite interesting talking about Australia and the tennis of next year and just the unknowns. And him and team, it's a really uncertain time just at the moment. Having got its feet back under it as a sport, suddenly everything, the foundations are rocking right now. And these next few days, I mean, when we spoke last night, at that time, Tennis Australia hadn't released any official sort of statement. Well, Craig Tiley has spoken in the last 24 hours. In fact, I think a couple of hours after we spoke, he didn't say an awful lot other than to say that he was in constant dialogue with the government and, you know, they were trying to get clarity as soon as possible because they understood the gravity of the uncertainty. But it's, trying to read anything into what's happened at the end of the year now and cast it forward to next year is a little bit pointless, really, because we just don't even know when next year will start. But hopefully in the next 2 or 3 days, we may have some further information. So anything else, Matt, quickly?
Well, I was going to say, do we need to have the what does this mean discussion? I take your point about the difficulty of forecasting. But, you know, it feels like quite a significant couple of days we've just had in terms of Medvedev and team beating Djokovic and Nadal. I mean, what are we reading into that?
Yeah, as much as I agree with everything you just said in your monologue, David, you have sort of put the kibosh on the tennis podcast there by saying forecasting and speculating is pointless. Because we have pledged to do podcasts for the next, the next forever.
Yeah.
Subject to Kickstarter backing.
I've been saving
and
my ideas,
given
Catherine.
There are no confirmed events, we really need to be able to forecast and speculate.
Oh, don't you worry. I've got a wealth of ideas for us to dig into that I thought I'd keep away from you while you were doing 12 hours of telly every day, you know. But tomorrow, when we have the meeting that you don't know about yet, we'll get into all that. But anyway, actually, just more generally, though, I'm sitting here thinking, well, what does it mean? same as it did when Tsitsipas and Dimitrov and all of these other people won when we thought this was some massive moment.
None of them had reached a Grand Slam final.
Look, I feel like Medvedev and team are clearly the next best behind those three. And actually, it's quite interesting hearing team say that he would put Rublev in that little mix of players based on his five titles. He's the one player he would put into the group amongst the ranking positions as being a top player in the world right now. But I still feel that when you get to the slams, it's just different. And these people have still got to figure out that way of winning them when the others are there. Now, team, yes, he has won one, but it is still the year that Nadal didn't play and Novak Djokovic got defaulted and Roger Federer wasn't there. The Australian Open, when it does happen, will be fascinating. If everybody's fit, we know that Djokovic, well, he's so amazing at that tournament. And Nadal, there's no real reason, unless he has an injury problem, that he should be subpar, given the way he looks right now. It's still different. We've got that evidence for the last 3 years. We've got that evidence. We had Dimitrov losing to Kyle Edmund at the Australian Open. We had Zverev losing to Milos Raonic, horribly, if you remember. And then we had Tsitsipas. I can't even remember who he... I think he lost to Raonic as
well. Yeah, Medvedev. Yeah. Medvedev will be quaking if he sees Raonic in his section of the draw in Australia.
So, you know, it's different. And it'll change eventually, but I don't feel absolutely... I feel very confident in Dominic Thiem as being a regular part of the big four or five now, if you want to call it. Medvedev, as much as I'm impressed with him, I still think has got some proving to do on that score.
I certainly agree with you, big picture. We need to wait for the slams until we start kind of declaring this as those four dreaded words, changing of the guard. But I do think I agree with Catherine that this edition felt different to Dimitrov, Zverev and Tsitsipas, partly because of what Medvedev and team have already done in the slams. And also I think what they did in this tournament, they both beat Nadal and Djokovic. I know it wasn't at the slams, but I always talk about this kind of pack hunter thing that the big three have got going on. I think it's significant that two players have shown that they can beat two of the big three in the same event. And I know they've got to convert that to best of five. Medvedev has never won a five-set match. He's zero wins, six losses when it goes to five sets. That's quite a big hurdle you would think he would need to overcome. But something about Medvedev kind of physically outlasting Nadal and team the way he did, team beating Djokovic in that style of not quite having their best tennis but winning, they kind of did to the big three what they've been doing to everyone for years. And it felt to me like the most significant data point yet, I suppose, of the gradual shift, the gradual generational shift. This is all to say that a few weeks ago, we were gobsmacked by the level that Nadal and Djokovic were producing in that French Open final and saying, you know, it's no wonder no one's been able to break through. So I take that as well, but it felt significant to me these last 2 days.
I approve of how brilliantly you've put that.
Funny, isn't it?
That was very compelling.
We both listened to the golf podcast, No Laying Up, and they had that sort of conversation after the most recent major golf tournament, the US Masters, and they're talking about how many majors are Dustin Johnson and Rory McIlroy and Brooks Koepka going to end up with, and they suffer from the same recency issues as we do, and how difficult it is to put those out of your mind and get some context. But of all the people, Matt, you're the one I trust. So because you don't get swept up like me. But anyway, Medvedev got me a consolation goal. today in the predictions for the year, because I think I was on minus 161 points at the start of the day, and I'm now only on minus 135 or something like that. So
did we do official predictions?
Yes, we did, Catherine. You picked Nadal.
Yeah, we both went for Nadal.
Oh, right. Yep. Okay. Yeah. So I wasn't even in the game today, at the start of today.
It was only me in the game today.
Right, okay.
And I won. But, you know, it's like I said, it's a consolation goal. I've still been beaten 9-1 by you and 6-1 by Matt, effectively.
Okay.
You know.
We'll take that.
Catherine's won everybody, and there is a graph that will show that. And Catherine looks at it on a daily basis.
It's a really great graph.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Now, this doubles. What happened? Jürgen Meltzer lost. I know that.
I can see that you made considerable notes about that.
I do know. It's Wesley Kuhlhoff and Nikola Mektic, who, why are they playing together for the final time? They've just won the title, 6-2-3, 6-10-5, and they're splitting up.
They've just won their first title and their last title.
Yes, the only team ever to win their first doubles title at the ATP Finals.
And they're splitting up.
You would think you would save that conversation until afterwards.
Mektic has just dumped him to go to play with Pavic, hasn't he?
Well, you assume that, I mean, who did the dumping first? These are the really important questions. So yes. Wesley Kuhlhoff is going to play with Lucas Kubot. Lucas Kubot, who was playing here with Marcelo Melo. And Nikola Mektic is going to play with Matej Pavic. Now, Nikola Mektic and Matej Pavic are both Croatian, so that could be potentially with a view to the Olympics. Although, if they were inclined to form partnerships with a view to Olympics, you'd think that they would have done that this time last year, when everyone is expecting an Olympics to happen in August of this year. So I sort of think Daniela Hantikova made the point on our Prime coverage that she thinks the COVID situation and travel restrictions make players more inclined to want to play with someone in their country, mm-hmm. so that literally they are nearby for them to be able to hit with and practice with if they are sort of grounded at home. But, having said all of that, it seems really bonkers that they went into that match today knowing that even if they had their respective best ever days on the tennis court, and make no mistake, I think it was that for both Kulhoff and Mektić. They were going to part ways afterwards, ensuring that they could never have such a day again together.
Unless they join up together again, but you know, yeah.
Which Greg and Daniela predicted. Greg said, I don't think the split will last 6 months. And Daniela said, no, Greg said, I predict they'll get back together in 6 months. And Daniela said, oh, I don't even think it'll be that long.
Wow. So much fun, isn't it?
And yeah, I mean, who knows what's going on behind the scenes? Maybe they hate one another.
I don't know.
It's like you never know what's going on in a person's relationship. And you know, when a celebrity couple that everybody's sort of in love with from afar split up and you go, oh, no, why couldn't they just stay together? They seem so happy together. It seems so, you know, they looked so good together. Maybe it's like that. But
yeah, because people don't necessarily want to just let everybody know what's happening, do they?
But you think if they hated one another, they probably wouldn't be winning one of the biggest titles in the world together. And they have such a... I mean, they're great strength. They beat Édouard Roger Vasselin and Jürgen Meltzer today, who sort of, as individuals, are stronger tennis players. And they beat them, and they were the best team this week on the basis of their sort of typical double skills, a real understanding as a team, anticipation, this instinctive awareness of where one another are on the court and where they're going to move to. I mean, that's the holy grail for a doubles team, isn't it? I mean, yes, there's a chance that Kulhoff will have that with Kubot and Mektić will have that with Pavic, but seems like a big risk to me.
Mm. And especially for Kulhoff, because he's a guy who doesn't win much. He had lost 15 of his last 17 finals with about 7 or 8 different partners. He has chopped and changed, and suddenly he's found someone, and they've won one of the biggest titles available, and it is no more. I mean, maybe there's something in that. Maybe with so many partners, there's something about him. But I don't know.
We need to do a doubles deep dive about this stuff to find out what really goes on.
Gossip deep dive into doubles.
I am desperate to know. Desperate.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll get on it. By the way, just quickly, actually, we should talk about Jürgen Meltzer. This is his final match of his career, or is he planning to play something next year if it's on?
There is some confusion over this. I think the answer to both those things is, I think both those things are correct. I think this is sort of his last competitive proper match of his career, but he kind of hopes to be able to play a couple of testimonials next year, to all intents and purposes. His relationship with Édouard Roger Vasselin is coming to an end. Roger Vasselin is teaming up with Henri Kontinen next year. Jürgen Meltzer, he's 39. I think he's already accepted a job with the Austrian Federation starting in February. But he basically wants to be able to play in front of a crowd. Again, he wants to be able to go out in front of a crowd, which is very understandable. So the Austrian Federation have given him the okay, and the Grand Slams have, I think, indicated that they would be amenable to giving him a wild card. Well, no, he wouldn't need a wild card, would he? I suppose it depends who he plays with, which is up in the air, because Edouard Roger Vasselin has trotted off into the sunset with Henri Kontinen. He has indicated that he, if it were possible, would play the Australian Open and or Wimbledon in order to go out, hopefully, in front of some crowds. But that all feels very uncertain. So I'd say there would have been a good portion of Jürgen Meltzer's brain today that was treating that as his swan song.
Yeah. Now, we've talked a lot about how the landscape has changed inevitably in tennis at the moment. And and just as a quick snapshot of that, I was just looking at the prize money won this year in the singles by Daniil Medvedev, which is 1.564 million. So $1.5 million. Last year, Stefanos Tsitsipas won more than $1 million, more than that. He won $2.65 million, and Medvedev's won $1.56 million. It's pretty jarring, isn't it, to see the difference. The total prize fund is $5.7 million compared to $9 million a year ago. Yeah, that's the new world we're in, just at the moment. Mm.
I'm pretty impressed and staggered that the numbers are still so big, frankly. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously a huge drop-off, but it's, yeah, given the circumstances, going from 17,000 fans twice a day, you know, two sessions of 17,000 people, hospitality included in that.
It's true.
To nothing. I think it's pretty impressive that the numbers are still what they are.
Yeah, agreed. So it is the 12th year. This tournament came to the O2 Arena for the first time in 2009 and was won by Nikolai Davydenko in the final. And he beat Roger Federer along the way for the first time in his career. I think he got a horrendous record against him until that match. It was the one that began with Andy Murray facing Juan Martin Del Potro, I always remember, in the first group match in 2009. And then in the end, despite the fact that he beat Del Potro, it was Del Potro who edged Murray out, I think, by a single game in the game percentages into the semifinals.
That was back in the days when nobody... Well, I say back in the days, in the UK government, we seem still to be in those days, but nobody could properly work an Excel spreadsheet.
No, they've really got their act together since that.
And test and trace gag for you there.
they know. It's quite funny as I was looking at the order of play from back then, and they were playing two matches from 7 p.m. singles and the doubles, and the doubles first, and the singles was not before 8:45, and they had one 3-hour epic, and I never forget the exodus of people who suddenly realised the tubes were about to close down, and there was no way of extending them. There were quite a few teething problems in that first year. I mean, inevitably, you know, given the scale of the event and it being new, but it's been a massive success, really, hasn't it? Way beyond what I could have expected. I mean, as you said, best part of 250,000 people through the doors every year. The city just and the people of the city just really took it to their hearts. They just loved going out for a night out. There was a different atmosphere in the night sessions to what there was in the afternoon sessions. The matches weren't always great, I think. I think you can maybe be a bit misty-eyed about the quality of it all, but often you would get to the end of the year and a player would lose a tight first set and the second. There was no chance that anybody was going to make a comeback, you know. But what stands out for you, Catherine? Do you have any specific favourite memories of this tournament?
Goodness. Well, I was at that first final, Davydenko Del Potro, as a fan with my dad. I think you organised me tickets for that, and we decided not to get the tube because of fears about getting home, because the horror stories that year about trying to get the tube out of there were so severe. We drove, and in typical me and my dad fashion, when I'm with my mum, we're, you know, an hour early for everything. But my dad and I had underestimated the traffic, and we were very, very late. And I think we saw, yeah, I mean, the final couple of games of Nikolai Davydenko winning the title, which, all due respect to Nikolai Davydenko, possibly wasn't exactly what we'd been hoping to witness.
Hang on, so you'd missed the doubles as well?
We'd missed the doubles. We'd missed every competitive portion of the singles. And we just sort of got there for Davidenko's trophy lift, living the tennis spectator dream. It was still very enjoyable, David. Thank you. Thank you for the tickets.
You're welcome. Did you need me to organise you a dental trip before it?
I also, I mean, I've already referenced it. I vividly remember watching on the telly after that final group stage match involving Del Potro, when extraordinarily nobody knew. Mm. Nobody knew what the scenario was. And yes, it was the tournament's first year in London, but the tournament had existed before that,
yeah,
with the same rules.
They didn't have a computerised mechanism for this to be worked
truly
out.
Truly extraordinary that that wasn't automated.
I do remember one of the all-time hilarious rants from my colleague at BBC Radio, Jonathan Overend, who just started raging about the people that were in front of him not knowing what was going on. And meanwhile, I think Del Potro had finished his match. He was hitting some balls with Carlos Tevez or something, yes, like that on the court, whilst Murray was tweeting, "Does anybody know what's going on? Am I through?" And Jonathan was shouting, "Look at these clowns with their clipboards," and trying to work it all out. But I mean, you know, to remember it, it's a footnote, isn't it, really? Because these problems never surfaced again. As soon as that happened, they realised the things they needed to do right the next year. And the organisation of the event, I mean, look, I'm slightly biased because the organiser, one of the brains behind it was Chris Commode, and he's somebody I worked with for many years at Queen's, but it's just exactly what he's good at, just putting on an event, understanding that you could play twice a day with two completely separate audiences and pack the place out, even if it's not Roger Federer who's on the order of play, and that's what happened. So, yeah, it's been a massive success. You got any highlights, Matt? Personal favourites?
Yeah, lots. I think it was interesting the point you made about maybe we can get a bit misty-eyed about the actual tennis. I think the way I will look back on the tennis that's been played is that, considering the era that the ATP finals were at the O2, considering the players, there was probably not a very high number of sort of absolute classic matches that you might expect, considering this was basically the year of the big four. But I would say that every year, pretty much, there was some kind of saving grace match. You know, there tended to be one epic that you remembered. And I think those matches, I'm thinking Team Djokovic last year, Murray Raonic in 2016, Federer Wawrinka 2014. You know, there was always some sort of epic match, it felt like. But I think one of my main kind of impressions of it is I first went to it in 2010. And I think the only tennis I'd ever been to before that was Wimbledon. And I think what was so important about this event, we kind of take it for granted now because we're so used to it, but they marketed themselves and branded themselves as completely different to Wimbledon for that London audience who may have only experienced Wimbledon. And they sort of showed you that tennis could be different. You know, it could have flashing lights. It could have player entrances. It could have a heartbeat. And I think the show has always been incredible, and they've always had some wonderful atmospheres as well. I actually found myself feeling really quite sad today. It was mainly Catherine's fault, because she just did such a wonderful pitch about the end of the O2 era on Prime, reflecting on kind of the poignancy of being there, and it really did make me think this event is not getting the send-off it deserves. And I think part of that is because we don't do this much in tennis. It doesn't happen that you leave a venue that much. One of the things I love so much about tennis is it goes back to the same places, the same physical spaces every year. And, you know, walking around the grounds at all the slams, all the Master Series 500s, you do feel a sense of history and a sense of meaning. And you know, I suppose it's the same with all venues, isn't it? Theatres or football stadiums, they all they all have some kind of atmosphere of everything that's of all the performances or the moments that have happened in the past. And I don't know, they kind of become a bit of the fabric and they create this character. And the ATP finals have been at the O2 long enough that that venue had a tennis character to it. When you went into that stadium, you remembered the previous matches. And I love the idea of that event moving around. And I think it's probably the right time. And I think it should move around. But it had been there long enough that so many people have created memories there. And I think that was why it's kind of sad to kind of leave them behind, I suppose.
Yeah. Gosh, how wonderfully put. It hasn't been just a vessel, has it, for the tennis? It's exactly as you said, it's become part of the fabric of it. And I'm experiencing that real end of event sadness. Not right now. I'm very happy to be doing this podcast and recording with you. I'm very grateful for it, because as I was walking the very, very short walk from the arena back to the hotel, I mean, it's practically the same building. I had a real heavy heart, and I actually wondered if I would get that this year, because usually that end of event depression or lull comes a result of the loss of adrenaline and the loss of energy, the loss of the rush that you get from being on site in an event with 17,000 people and everything that comes with that. And the answer is, I mean, I'm sure it's amplified because it's the poignancy of the last event, last time it's held here in London. But I can confirm I very much do have that end of event feeling of sadness. And I think that probably tells me something about the week that I've experienced, that in spite of there not being any crowds, and that has made me desperately sad, and that feeling hasn't been alleviated over the course of the week. If anything, actually, it's got worse. But in spite of all of that, this event has given me an energy. It's energized me, and it has given me that rush of adrenaline that this sort of event should. And I'm gonna miss it this week.
The other thing it has done for this country is it's just let people know that tennis isn't just the summer. It's November. And that's what's been happening for the last 12 years, that the country has been aware of tennis in November, which if you consider in a year's time, and look, I think Turin can be a fantastic home for it. I think that there could be a wonderful energy there. I think it's the right time for that country with the amount of thriving tennis players coming out of it and the infrastructure they have. I think it can be fantastic, you know, pandemic willing, etc. But the effect of it in this country is going to be significant, in that the BBC, for instance, are not going to cover it next year. This is the end of the BBC TV coverage of this event now, at least for the time being. They don't have any plans to cover it next year. Now, I'm sure it'll be wonderfully presented, hopefully, by Catherine Whittaker on site in Turin, because she did an incredible job. And I'm not just saying that because she's looking at me, but she did. But obviously, terrestrial coverage is a big deal for awareness of the sport. And yeah, as I said, 250,000 people, the best part of, normally come to the event in November. And that was a huge boon to the sport over the last 12 years.
Without question, it showed people that tennis didn't have to be summer, and it didn't have to be strawberries and cream and Pims. It didn't have to be blazers and tradition. I think there's a place for all of that, and I love so many aspects of it. I'm not trashing Wimbledon and tradition. It's beautiful and it's wonderful, but it is not for everyone, and it's not necessarily inclusive. And you know, I realise this event hasn't been the peak of inclusivity. It's still been expensive and sometimes hard to get to, etc., etc. But it definitely has made tennis accessible in this country to a completely different demographic of people. I have friends and acquaintances and friends of friends that have never really even considered going to Wimbledon, but have come to this. Mm. And that's going to be missed. All of that is going to be missed. I hope it will have a legacy. I hope for a generation of people, it will have made them think about tennis in a slightly different way, but it will certainly be missed.
Very well said. Lovely memories. And yeah, I'm really chuffed that we've been able to cover it with daily podcasts this week, even though Matt and I weren't able to be on site this time. But it's great that you were, and to be able to give us a real insight into what it felt like to be there. Should we finish on a jollier note? Because it all feels a bit down in the dumps, doesn't it? And we do have one or two loose ends to pick up from last night, because you may remember I did ask the very important question, what is a meme? And I've looked it up. And I can tell you, Mum, that a meme is an amusing or interesting item, such as a caption, picture or video, or genre of items that is spread widely online, especially through social media. So there you are. Then I went and had a look at the Urban Dictionary, which said that memes are graceful, exquisite entities bestowed upon us, bestowed on us filthy peasants, which are sporadically known to drift one into a sea of existential crises. This is also an exemplary method of eliminating depression once and for all. When all was lost, memes cured my depression. That's what the Urban Dictionary says. And Catherine was a meme yesterday. Somebody's also written that they would like a meme of me asking what is a meme.
You know, I think you can study memes now.
Can you?
Mm. I think there are sort of modules in university courses on memes.
You could see Catherine's face right now.
Mm. Yeah. I'm not sure I was a meme. I think you have to have an enduring impact to be a meme.
Well, you're our meme. The Tennis Podcast's official meme. by the way, I've had a couple of people jump to my defence about Greece 2. Dan Connolly, the Alistair Cook impersonator, and also actor, said David Law Tennis is right. Greece 2 is great. Michelle Pfeiffer is everything, and some of the songs are absolute tunes. Hashtag cool rider.
I'm not saying Greece 2 isn't fine or decent or good or whatever you want to call it. I'm just saying you don't talk about the Grease movies. It's Grease and then some subsequent related movies that may or may not be good and you may or may not have enjoyed, and good luck to you if you did, that's fine. But it's Grease.
Alan Palmer says, recently discovered Tennis Podcast, which I love. However, the Grease 2 diss from Catherine Whittaker Sport was a hard knock to take. Glad that David Law Tennis is a fan.
I enjoyed Grease 2.
This is meant to be the note to finish on, not the argument.
It's not
David.
Iconic. Grease is iconic, and Grease 2 was a good film riding on its coattails. Nobody talks about the Grease movies. It's not a thing. I'm not trashing Grease 2. It's an enjoyable watch. But Grease stands on its own.
I do actually agree. the only sequel, has there ever been a sequel better than the original?
Toy Story 2.
Oh, well, that's controversial. I love Toy Story.
Yeah, so do I. They're all great. And I'm
Paddington 2.
Yes, strong agree with Paddington 2.
Shrek 2. Shrek 2 is amazing. It is.
Yeah, but these are all movies which I think is okay to treat as a collection.
Right.
Unlike Grease. And Grease 2 separately.
Agreed. We got any shout-outs, Matt?
Yes, we do. And I should say, I think these are our last shout-outs of the year. If anyone has been listening to all 137 episodes waiting for their shout-out and they're not in this next group of three, then please get in touch and I will check my list. But I think these are our last three. And I should say that we still have some intros left, so we will be using those throughout our remaining podcasts. So if you've not heard your intro yet, those are to come.
This is episode 140. I'm just able to confirm that.
Right, okay. So the final three shout-outs, and I'm going to do them as a group. They are for Trevor Law, Barbara Law, and Sally Ann Law.
Well, two of those I'm related to.
Oh, are you not related to the other one?
I mean, maybe I'm related to Sally Ann. But the first two are my parents. But Sally Ann, you're a legend with a magnificent name. And I deeply appreciate your support. And thanks, Mum and Dad.
Does that mean your mum and dad contributed separately to the Kickstarter?
Yeah, my mum's been
in
doing
order
it
to
for,
get separate shout-outs?
I think so. My mum's been doing
it
for a while.
Oh, that's so lovely.
And I'm going to be bigging up our show here, but I gave them a call this morning, and I said, have you been your walk yet? And they said, we were just about to go, and we thought we'd watch half the podcast before the walk and half after it. We'd listen to half the podcast before and half after it. But then the story about the fall began halfway through, and they couldn't leave the house until they finished it. And then they said they found it all very amusing. So,
hello, Trevor and Barbara, and also Sally Ann.
Yeah, Sally Ann's awesome.
In the same way that Grease and Grease 2 should perhaps be treated as separate entities. Barbara and Trevor, you are Grease. Sally Ann, you are the also great and enjoyable, but separate Grease 2.
I think this might be my favourite shout-out moment of the year. We had a great one in Australia. Do you remember where the person who received the shout-out, David, said, oh, she's staying in my house.
Factual.
Yes, but this is also a great one. I was so confident that I had a trio of the same Law family.
Magnificent. Great job, Matt.
I've got one additional pseudo shout out. Well, no, just shout out, frankly. An additional submission. It's not a member of the Law family or imposter member of the Law family, and I don't know their names, which is why I want to give them a shout out, because I'm so terribly sorry. I was stopped by a group of people who I think were involved with the Ball Kids in the lobby this evening as I was returning from the hotel. Whilst I was having my poignant sad walk back from the O2 to the hotel, and they stopped me and asked for a photo and said they loved the podcast. There were three of them. And I'm so sorry. I was so sort of flustered and embarrassed and, you know, having profound thoughts that I didn't ask for your names. But one of them, as I said, oh, thanks so much, bye, started giving me a round of applause as I walked towards the lift.
Was that fall related, I wonder?
And I wish I'd acknowledged that, because it was the loveliest thing, but I didn't know what to do with it. It was so nice, really. So thank you.
Can we also make
thank
a
you.
Mention?
I mean, they probably haven't listened this far because, you know, the
Nobody
last 10 minutes have
two,
been
they?
Me reviewing Grease 2. But if you have, there's your reward, and thank you.
We know that nobody's listened to this bit, so we can just have a good laugh and do whatever we like. Can we also mention Billie Jean?
Yeah.
Because today is Billie Jean King's 77th birthday. So happy birthday, Billie Jean King.
And happy birthday.
Have you seen the videos of her playing tennis on her birthday?
Yes.
No,
I have.
Oh, I must
they
see that.
Are great.
So good.
Fantastic. But we were given some news today on Billie Jean King's 77th birthday that was equally magnificent. Catherine, the floor is yours.
Well, I've become a 2020 lockdown cliche, and I've got a puppy.
Hooray!
I've gone and done it, folks. Rosie, if you're listening, I still love you very, very much. You're my favourite. But fans of the show will know how very much I fell in love with Magnus this summer, in spite of his pooing live on the podcast. That's how adorable he was.
Our final Wimbledon relived show, if anyone wants to go back to that moment.
So I will soon be welcoming Magnus's sister into the Whittaker family, and she will be and is already called Billie Jean because not Michael Jackson, basically. It's very important to say named after Billie Jean King and not after the music of Michael Jackson. Yeah. And I'm very aware that I'll spend the rest of her life explaining that she's not named after Michael Jackson. But I still think it's a worthwhile price to pay for her being named after someone so iconic and inspirational.
Wonderful. We very much look forward to meeting Billie Jean. And there are photos on our Twitter and Instagram accounts if you'd like to go and have a look. She's lovely. So, go and do that. Right. Now, that's it. Tennis podcasts are over for the ATP Finals in 2020. They ain't over for 2020 overall, though, because we're going to be back next week. Come on. Is that some enthusiasm?
I'm doing a big smile.
Me too.
Oh, yeah. Is that what it is? I thought that was a grimace. But no, it's a smile. It's a smile. Magnificent.
I'm dreading tomorrow without doing any broadcasting.
How long do we leave it until we have the meeting that I've got planned?
Tuesday.
Right, okay. Very firm Tuesday there, folks. Definitely not Monday. That's not happening. But yes, we're not going to stop. We're going to be back next week, and then we're going to be with you throughout December as well. We are going to be busy planning as well 2021, which may not have an Australian Open in January. You know what that means, don't you? AO Relift is under works in my head as we speak. Anyway, we'll see. We'll see what happens. But our crowdfunding campaign for 2021 begins on the 1st of December. We have a link in our show notes right now if you'd like a reminder on the day, the exact moment that we send that live, if you want to be at the front of the queue for any of the various categories that we've got with pet mascots, and we've got lots of those, and predictions, competitions, and all sorts of things. So, thanks to everybody who's backed us over the course of this year, but also just thanks for everybody that's listened and taken something out of the show and enjoyed it and sent us really nice notes to let us know. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's just been a brilliant week. I think it's funny. I mean, I've missed being at the O2 this week. It's the first one I've not been at in its 12 years, but I've probably enjoyed this, the podcast process of the last week, more than the other years when we were there. It's just been absolute. We've had a ball. It's been amazing.
We have.
So, thank you both.
Assist to Douglas Hurd for that.
Yeah, there's a full 10 minutes of laughing that didn't make it into yesterday's podcast.
I can confirm that. Yes, that's absolutely true. Matt, Catherine, thank you so much for doing this. I love it. We'll be back with more of them in the future very, very soon. See you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.